Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. And I mean that sincerely. And now, before we do anything else...
Hi! High def, low def, no def, take my hand. It's a digital wonderland.
News of the digital wonderland, won't you?
Got to be so careful where you stand. In the digital wonderland.
First, an email from John. Hi, Harry. Our local public station doesn't carry your show anymore. That shows good taste. But I remember how you would rail against digital television. It has finally come to Wisconsin, and it is a bill of goods. Literally, I bought a converter box and then a new set of rabbit ears with an amplifier, and I still get a crappy picture and poor sound. I live in an apartment on the wrong side of the building. I got an email from our local public station. Their tune has changed. I guess they're getting a lot of complaints. Now they're saying it isn't their fault, that the change was forced by the federal government. Apparently, the local stations are freaking out because their revenues are down because of the economy, and now they're losing at least 5% of their audience. I answered the email from my public station suggesting the problem was rooted in campaign contributions and that the contributions would eventually start moving in another direction. I miss your show. Hey, me too. I miss me. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, on the other hand, is planning a station survey to determine the extent of a problem that has crept up practically unnoticed during the planning. Planning! For the digital transition. What public broadcasters can or should do with the old analog equipment. Yeah, they wouldn't think of that. Engineers, that's right. Some stations are simply letting the equipment sit while they ponder its fate, but that can take up a huge amount of space. Many analog TV transmitters are the size of three refrigerators in a row, accompanied by a high-voltage power supply nearly as big. The obsolete analog antennas still perched in the sky add weight to aging towers that threaten to topple on equipment below. Please give. Selling all this outdated stuff poses its own complications, including federal liens, university property disposal rules, and the glut of retired hardware that has few buyers. Paying recyclers to scrap it for material sometimes costs more than would be gained, especially for the copper and antenna lines hundreds of feet up. And simply dumping it may be complicated due to hazardous waste regulations. Broadcasting insiders were caught off guard by a question from the audience during a panel last month in Washington. William Cooperman of the Public Telecommunications Facilities Program admitted it's something we'll have to look at, which distinguishes it from actual digital television. And here's good news in the digital wonderland, ladies and gentlemen. Federal regulators said this week they are going into search and rescue mode, to help the millions of consumers unprepared for the phase transition to digital television, culminating now with a June 12th transition deadline. Place your bets. The millions of consumers waiting for coupons for digital converter boxes will finally receive them within the next 2.5 weeks, thanks to emergency funding for the coupon program provided in the stimulus package. That's right. Money in the stimulus package for converter boxes for digital television. Not one penny for the rebuilding of the failed levees or for coastal wetlands restoration in the New Orleans area. Priorities, babe. The National Telecommunications and Information Administration is ratcheting up its outreach to consumers most likely to be unprepared for the transition. Searching for a March Madness analogy, Acting FCC Commissioner Chairman Michael Kopp said, quote, "We might have survived the first round game, but the games are only going to get tougher." In sincerity, he added, "There are no analogies, nothing from which to draw parallels. This is why a phase transition is so helpful. It's too bad we had to get to a phase transition so painfully," unquote. Yeah, there are no parallels. We never switched from black and white to color. The transition has been painful in large part because the National Telecommunications Administration has had to put millions of consumers on a waiting list for the $40 coupons after it spent the $1.3 billion initially provided for the coupon program until the stimulus package came to the rescue. The coupons will now take an average of only 9 days to reach consumers rather than 21, now that the administration has moved from bulk postage to first class. It's digital. First class mail, babe. The agency has also changed its rules so it will be able to send replacement coupons to people with expired coupons. That took a policy change. But there are about 16 million, that's all, people with expired coupons. The agency expects only about half of those people to request new ones, so they'll, of course, be unprepared when the rest do. The funding will allow for a total of 12 million more coupons to be issued. It is unlikely, say the people at the administration, that there will have to be another waiting list. Yeah, everything's unlikely until it happens. The digital wonderland, ladies and gentlemen, it beckons. It beckons with digital arms. Hello, welcome to the show.
Vinny's looking for a bang, jazz funk, thrash rock, with distortion on, distortion on. The moving, grooving, grinding, cruising, dissidents. 12-tone beat. Atonal heat, nonsense cause it always me. You got it right, you got it wrong, but sorry, I'll pass your number on. Looking for a band, the give you your pain in the butt. You waste a lot of time, eat a lot of nuts. Like Vinny, the meatball, he was a real eat-all. Who could, would, express, square, use the best. Hot terminology, but to me, that's all corneology. Come on, make a stand, bring your own plan. Be yourself, or let it go.
Vinny's looking for the pepper sound. Still red hot, but heavy up mouth. Bring your arm.
Just please don't.
from the edge of America, from the home of the homeless. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. And I have not really spent a lot of time on this issue because a lot of other people have. And, you know, my time is short. So, but this is just too good to pass up. After 3 months of investigation, California's Secretary of State has released a report examining why a voting system made by Premier Election Solutions. Now, you know that Blackwater changed their name to Z. But Premier Election Solutions is the new name of Diebold or Diebold. Why that system lost 200 ballots in Humboldt County, Northern California, during last November's presidential election. The most startling information in the report is not why the system lost votes, but that some version of the company's vote tabulation system, the Global Election Management System, include a button that allows someone to delete audit logs from the system. Audit logs are required under the federal voting system guidelines. They're used to test and qualify voting systems for use in elections. The logs record changes and other events that occur on voting machines to ensure the integrity of elections and help determine what occurred in a system when something goes wrong. Deleting a log is something you would only do in decommissioning a system that you're no longer using, says Princeton University computer scientist Ed Felton. In normal operation, the log should always be kept, he added. Yet the Diebold or Diebold system in Humboldt County has a button labeled clear. Clear. Now, don't you feel better? Oh, sorry. Clear that permits deletion of certain audit logs that contain records that would be essential to reconstruct actions of any operator of the machine during vote tallying. The button is positioned right next to print and save as. That's convenient. Oh, look, there's clear. Making it easy for an election official to click on it by mistake and erase crucial logs. The report says this occurred recently in a California county when an official, while attempting to print out a copy of a log, inadvertently deleted it instead. That's good ergonomics. The system provides no warning to the operator that clicking on the button will result in permanent deletion of records in the log, nor does it require the operator to confirm the action before executing it. I mean, the cheapest, cheesiest computer says, are you sure you want to delete this? Not this thing. Premier Diebold was aware that having a clear button on its system was a bad idea, according to California's report. One of the system's developers wrote in an email way back in 2001, quote, adding a clear button is easy, but there are too many reasons why doing that is a bad idea, unquote. The company included the button in the system anyway. Hey, we're the bad ideas people. That's why. The button was removed from software versions 1.18.20 and following, but they never went back to jurisdictions using the previous versions to upgrade them. And version 1.18.19 is still used in three California counties as well as in other states. It's unclear how many previous versions of the software had the button or why it was included in the first place. Well, I know why. It sounds nice. Clear. Doesn't that feel better? It's a clear button. Everything's clear. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, shall we? The award-winning news of the warm. I forget to say that sometimes because I lose so many awards.
Soft, listen to the warm.
I don't lose them. They're under the bed. Scientists predict that warmer air caused by climate change will lead to rainstorms becoming more intense and more frequent in Great Britain during the autumn, winter, and spring. That leaves one season. The quantity of rain which falls during extreme downpours will increase by up to 30% by 2070 for some parts of Britain. This could mean up to 3.2 inches of rain falling in a day. The researchers fear that severe flooding, similar to that which hit much of England during the summer of 2007, will become far more common. Now, at least it won't be snow. I know they can't handle that. Lizards are among the most common reptiles on Earth. However, new research that builds on data collected more than three decades ago demonstrates that lizards living in tropical forests in Central and South America and the Caribbean could be in serious peril from rising temperatures associated with climate change. In fact, those forest lizards, tropical forest lizards, appear to tolerate a much narrower range of survivable temperatures than do their relatives at higher latitudes, and are actually less tolerant of high temperatures, says Raymond Huey at the University of Washington. The least heat-tolerant lizards in the world are found at the lowest latitudes in the tropical forests. I find that amazing, says Huey. It's often been assumed that tropical organisms are much better at dealing with high temperatures because the lowland tropics are always warm. But that assumption is only true to a point, Huey says, because those in the tropical forest experience a much narrower range of temperatures during the year and are rarely, if ever, exposed to extreme high temperature. A lizard in Washington, for example, might experience a temperature range of 40 degrees or more between summer and winter. One in Puerto Rico might only experience a range of 20 to 25 degrees. Forest conditions tend to keep lizards living there at temperatures that allow them to function at or close to their physical peak. A temperature change of just a few degrees can reduce their physical performance greatly. So I guess in the future, no lizard's going to be winning no Olympics. Lizards are ectotherms. Did you know that? That you'll win a bar bet today, regulating their body temperature by exchanging heat with their surroundings. I guess we're endotherms, aren't we? Can we be endotherms just for a day? Dateline Paris, birds in Europe are already feeling the heat from climate change, with three species suffering reduced ranges or population for everyone that benefits from warming, says a study published this week. Researchers found a strong match between data collected over three decades from a continent-wide monitoring network and computer models that forecast global warming's impact. Though we only have a very small actual rise in global average temperatures, it is staggering to realize how much change we're noticing in wildlife populations, says lead author Richard Gregory of the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds in Britain. If we don't take our foot off the gas now, our indicator shows there will be many much worse effects to come. Any increase in Earth's average temperature above 2.0 degrees compared to pre-industrial times will create global havoc for birds and other wildlife, he says. Study was published in the online journal PLOS-1. It analyzed data for 122 wild bird species, more than a fifth of the species known to nest in Europe. The number being negatively impacted was nearly three times greater than that benefit from climate change. So the losers outnumber the winners, just like real life. To avoid creating greenhouse gases, it makes more sense using today's technology to leave land unfarmed in conservation reserves rather than to plow it up for corn to make biofuel. This according to a Duke University-led study. Converting such conservation reserves to corn ethanol production is an inefficient and expensive greenhouse gas mitigation policy that should not be encouraged until ethanol production technologies improve, the study's authors say in the journal Ecological Applications. Nonetheless, farmers and producers are already receiving federal subsidies to grow more corn for ethanol under the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007. Yeah, there's money for that. One of our take-home messages is that conservation programs are currently a cheaper and more efficient greenhouse gas policy for taxpayers than corn ethanol production, says biologist Robert Jackson. Yeah, but what's Archer Daniels Midland going to do, guys? Have you figured that out? The Amazon is surprisingly sensitive to drought, according to new research conducted through the world's largest tropical forest. A 30-year study published this week in Science provides the first solid evidence that drought causes massive carbon loss in tropical forests, mainly through killing trees. For years, the Amazon forest has been helping to slow down climate change, but relying on this subsidy from nature is extremely dangerous, says Professor Oliver Phillips, the University of Leeds. If the Earth's carbon sinks, those are areas that absorb carbon dioxide, slow or go into reverse, as our results show is possible, carbon dioxide levels will rise even faster. Deeper cuts in emissions will be required to stabilize our climate. This study, global collaboration between more than, should be among more than 40 institutions, was based on the unusual 2005 drought in the Amazon. Who knew? This gave scientists a glimpse into the region's future climate, in which a warming tropical North Atlantic may cause hotter and drier seasons. The drought in 2005 sharply reversed decades of carbon absorption, in which Amazonia helped slow climate change. The drought caused a loss of more than 3 billion tons The total impact of the drought, 5 billion extra tons of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, exceeds the annual emissions of Europe and Japan combined. Visually, most of the forest appeared little affected, but our records prove tree death rates accelerated. Because the region is so vast, even small ecological effects can scale up to a large impact on the planet's carbon cycle, said Professor Phillips. Yeah. Yeah, feels good. I feel clear somehow. I don't know how that happened. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. It is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now...
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an
inspector general. Oh, yeah.
News of inspectors general. And New Orleans officials paid at least $4 million more than necessary for a crime camera system, most of which is faulty. Well, if most of it's faulty, I think none of the money is necessary then. The city's inspector general report came out this week, charging that under Mayor Ray Nagin, what's he doing with his promises? He's Ray Nagin. Officials in the technology office granted lucrative no-bid contracts and failed to monitor the contractors. The Inspector General Leonard Odom said a confidential report has been made to federal prosecutors on possible crimes. $4 million of taxpayer money was mismanaged and squandered, just as the city is having to tighten its belt. Well, they got it in just in time then. See, if they'd waited, you couldn't have done that. The CIA, meanwhile, destroyed videotapes that showed its agents subjecting high-level Al-Qaeda, suspected Al-Qaeda detainees to waterboarding and other brutal interrogation methods. And it destroyed those tapes after the agency's inspector general issued a classified report 5 years ago, concluding that the techniques used on the prisoners, quote, appeared to constitute cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment as defined by the International Convention Against Torture, unquote. Now, if we did that, that would be destroying evidence of a crime. But this isn't us. Previously, the CIA had signaled that it had only destroyed two videotapes and one audio tape of harsh interrogations. Hey, high-value detainees, we're harshing your mellow. But on Tuesday of this week, in a letter filed in federal court, acting U.S. Attorney Lev Dassin said 92 videotapes were destroyed. CIA Inspector General John Helgerson, who is retiring, and how can you blame him, viewed the videotapes that showed two detainees being subjected to waterboarding by CIA officers, which formed the foundation for his still-classified report and the CIA methods of interrogation. In his report, Helgerson also raised concern about whether the use of the techniques could expose agency officers to legal liability, according to a story in the 2005 November 9th edition of the New York Times that was published the same month the tapes were destroyed. Timing is everything. And finally, news of Inspector General. The Federal Emergency Management Agency does not properly secure thousands of laptops it manages, and as a result, sensitive personal information stored on those computers is not secure. That's according to a report by the parent agency, the Department of Homeland Security's Inspector General. FEMA has not ensured that 32,000 laptops it owns or manages adhere to minimum security settings or meet adequate laptop security computer inventory management procedures. Is there a clear button on those? As a result, sensitive information stored and processed on FEMA laptops may not be protected properly, says the Inspector General. The report indicates significant work remains for FEMA to further strengthen controls necessary to protect government-issued laptop computers. FEMA representatives did not respond this week to queries about what progress the agency has made in addressing the points raised in the report. Regional FEMA officials acknowledged, however, that 13 FEMA-issued laptops were stolen in just the past year. And, as if to confirm that it's still, it's in fine shape still, FEMA is alerting about 50 Northwest Indiana flood victims that there's more good news for them, even after the flood. Their personal information was on a FEMA laptop computer stolen from a housing inspector's car. FEMA spokesman Kat Langle says the laptop was stolen on November 4th in Griffith, Indiana, and immediately reported. She said the agency had no reports of identity theft resulting from the theft of the laptop. The password-protected laptop contained names, social security numbers, and other personal information of about 50 victims of last September's flooding. But as the San Diego desk, who is more technically savvy in these matters than I am, notes, you can password protect it all you want, but if it ain't encrypted, it's open season on your information. News of the Inspectors General, ladies and gentlemen, a password-protected feature of this broadcast.
Judge a man by scrutiny, oh, I say. Hello, from CPR, Continental Public Radio in Washington, I'm Cody Outscoop, and this is What Up Dog. What Up Dog, CPR's new news blogazine for the young and the newsless. Thanks for multitasking us into your day. I'm Cody Outscoop. You may have heard on our companion newscast for older listeners about the auction this week in New York of some of the effects of the founder of India, Mahatma Gandhi. We sure did. It sent us in search of a reporter who could give us the 411 on an even more unusual auction, and it turned out to be CPR's own special correspondent, Aviva Schlarman.
Word, Cody.
Said Aviva. So, dude, what could be more unusual than a Mahatma Gandhi auction?
He called me dude. Cody, at New York's Knickerbocker Galleries this week, we saw the auctioning off of the property of an icon of 20th century charity, Mother Teresa.
Well, pump the brakes there, sister. Wasn't she like the poorest woman on the planet?
Well, she served the poor, and to be honest, nobody would confuse her with, oh, who's a rich woman that the kids know, Oprah? But, of course, like anyone living in even the periphery of Western civilization, there were objects in Mother Teresa's life that might turn out to be valuable to somebody. Knickerbocker Galleries owner Freddie Vanderbilt thought long and hard about the possibilities.
I mean, if she isn't an icon, like, who is, you know, really? And we kind of specialize in the auctioning of important properties of contemporary icons. I mean, we just finished doing a very unique event. We conducted an auction of several hundred originals of Michael Jackson's legal bills. And in several cases, the bills went for more than the amount they were billing for.
Well, that must have been a first.
Well, that's what our press release said. So when Mr. Gustav Feldschreiber approached us with this extremely unique collection, we got very excited. Of course, we're always very excited. That's just sort of how we roll. But I mean, really excited.
So, Freddie, what actually was in this collection? What sort of possessions did Mother Teresa
possess? Well, there was a most unique lot that consisted of number 2 pencils on chains. Must have been 500 of them in all.
Pencils on chains.
Mm-hmm. From the documentation Mr. Feldschreiber provided, apparently she used to let the poor people she was feeding use the pencils to write down messages or Bible verses or whatever, but she didn't want them stealing the pencils.
Because she wanted other poor people to be able to use them?
I don't know. Maybe it's hard to get pencils in India. They may have gone straight to ballpoint technology or something.
Well, what else were people bidding on?
Oh, furious bidding. I mean, really intensely unique. Over lot 223, which was a half dozen head shawls.
This must have been the black shawls we saw her wearing in every news photo.
Well, apparently so. All the documentation indicated was that they were manufactured in Thailand, and because of the non-industrial process used to make them, their color ranged from grayish black to almost a bluish black. Very striking. The lot sold for $4,500, which, I'm telling you, in this economy, is quite remarkable.
And, Cody, this auction had quite a few celebrity bidders in attendance.
Drop some bold-faced names on us, Aviva.
Well, fashion icon Tim Gunn was there.
Oh, she was an icon. She could be disturbing, perplexing. Her look was austere. No ruching, nothing gathered, absolutely nothing cut on the bias. And yet, there was something almost drastically chic about her. She made it work. I loved her.
And what did you buy?
Oh, nothing. I was just a looky-loo.
Aviva, this Gustav Feldschreiber who put these things up for auction, what do we know about him?
Well, here's what Freddie Vanderbilt had to say about him.
He's a fiduciary agent of the Russian mafia, who, before their fortunes were decimated by the recent drop in the price of oil, began building collections of various kinds of valuables for resale on the international market, with himself receiving 20% off the top and depositing the proceeds in a portfolio of offshore shell banking entities. That's really all I know. Needless to say, he's quite a unique fellow. Apparently, he came into possession of these objects in Mumbai after Mother Teresa's former apartment was being prepared for condo conversion.
Freddie, what's your favorite object from this collection? If you could have bid, What would you have bid on?
Oh, honestly, I think that the Timex watch, if it just was a very important piece. We reset its time zone for the auction. It was still on Mumbai time when we opened the consignment, and it kept perfect time throughout the evening. And the leather band just couldn't have been more distressed.
A very undistressed auctioneer who, by the end of the evening, had gaveled $1,500,000 into those offshore banking entities, Cody.
That would buy a lot of pencils on chains, Aviva.
It sure would.
Aviva Schlorman, killer report on the Mother Teresa auction. Big props.
Thank you.
Tomorrow's just a few mouse clicks away, and that's when we're back with another posting of What Up Dog. Our thanks to the whole CPR News posse and to the John and Melinda Fry Foundation. Fry is fly. Till the next one, I'm Cody Outscoop. Peace out. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
And this is your local station, of course. Now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. Yeah, it was a pregnant pause. And it delivered. From the London newspaper The Independent, three separate bombings, including one in which a dead body was used to lure policemen to the scene, killed 15 people in Pakistan on just one day this week, underlining the helplessness of the authorities as they search in vain for the militant who attacked the Sri Lankan cricket team last week. That's our friend, Pakistan. Attacks emphasize that the civilian government of President Zardari is no more effective than the military rule of his predecessor, General Perv, at stemming the brutal advance of militancy across the country. British Foreign Secretary David Miliband appealed to Pakistan's civilian politicians to cease their infighting and unite against adversaries. Security agencies have warned that two-thirds of the terror plots Britain faces originate in Pakistan or are supported from there. Why, that would make it ground zero in the war on terror, wouldn't it? Hello? But the inability or unwillingness of Pakistan to curb the flow of militants into Afghanistan also poses a direct threat to British and American troops there. Recently, British members of Parliament were told that Pakistani generals still consider it in that country's interest, strategic interest, to have the Taliban, which was created by Pakistan's military intelligence service, in power in Kabul rather than President Karzai's government, which they believe is closer to India. Sean Gregory, head of the Pakistan Security Research Unit at Bradford University, told the Parliament Foreign Affairs Committee that Pakistan's role in the Taliban's comeback lies somewhere between passive tolerance and open and active support. Our ally, Pakistan. Britain, the U.S., and NATO find themselves, he says, reliant on a, quote, ally, unquote, which does not share their interests and whom they cannot trust. Other experts told the committee that Pakistan showed little interest in tackling militant commanders, both including two old Mujahideen leaders in Afghanistan who have thrown in their lot with al-Qaeda and with the foreign Islamists who have made their base in Waziristan. Good news about Pakistan, but wait, there's more. From The Independent as well, speaking for the first time since his release from Guantanamo Bay, Binyan Mohammed, a British subject released about a week and a half ago, claims that horrific torture he experienced while being held was directly influenced by the British government. Mohammed, actually he's a resident of Britain, not a subject, said secret telegrams sent by British spy agency MI5 to the CIA show that the men responsible for his torture were being influenced by questions from the British Security Service in London. He describes how after his capture in Pakistan in 2002, he was flown to Rabat in Morocco, where his chest and genitals were repeatedly cut by Moroccan interrogators working to American instructions. The High Court in London has already been told that Mohammed was interviewed in Pakistan by an MI5 officer who introduced himself as John. But until now, the allegation against Britain was that it only ever provided background information to the Americans during his subsequent detention in Morocco. The new evidence is contained in verbatim notes taken by Mohammed when he was given access to unclassified telegrams from a separate legal action he's fighting here in the United States. One memo from the MI5 sent during his detention in Pakistan suggests that the British saw themselves as central to his interrogation. Another report from Agence France-Presse says the same freed Guantanamo Bay prisoner, Bunyan Mohammed, says conditions at Guantanamo Bay have worsened since President Obama was elected. He claims guards wanted to, quote, take their last revenge. He calls the torture he received in Pakistan and Morocco medieval. I wonder if that's a compliment. You know, some would consider it high praise. And he says, the result of my experience is that I feel emotionally dead. It seems like a miracle my brain is still intact. Since the election, it's got harsher, he says, of the Guantanamo treatment. The guards would say, yes, this place is going to close down, but it was like they wanted to take their last revenge. He also claimed the feared emergency reaction force at Gitmo, a team which he said punishes inmates in their cells, and once almost gouged his eyes out when he declined to give his fingerprints, is now being used more often. He said he was beaten at Gitmo, said his chest and penis were slashed with razors while he was held in Morocco and Afghanistan. He lived in constant darkness and came close to insanity after being forced to listen to the same album by Eminem at top volume for a solid month. The U.S. never charged him with a crime. British police questioned him in return to Britain and let him go free. But he'll never forget Eminem. Why not Spinal Tap? Huh? And British newspaper The Guardian has other details. Punched with masked men. Subjected to psychological torture by being forced to listen to loud music, including Meatloaf. Damn it, why not Spinal Tap? News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Well, I tried to run my pants. She said, man, that's the same old thing I've heard before. And I'm too tired to go by your show. Play something mellow, play something I can sink my teeth in like yellow, play something I can understand.
so much. Ladies and gentlemen, the number of major legal errors, and I'll get to that in a moment. I just want to make the larger point here. I'm flattering myself. It's just entirely possible that the main benefit to come out of the election of Barack Obama to the presidency is just finding out all that went on during the Bush administration. Okay, so that's my premise here. And now, the number of major legal errors committed by Bush administration lawyers during the formulation of its early counterterrorism policies was far greater than previously known, according to internal Bush administration documents released for the first time by the Justice Department this week. These policies were based on at least 10 legal opinions conferring broad powers on the president that later on the Justice Department said were wrong and ordered them withdrawn, including several approving the military search, detention, or trial of civilians in the United States without congressional input, according to the documents. The Bush administration had previously acknowledged rescinding two of those memos, the ones authorizing the infliction of pain and suffering on detainees and claiming unquestioned authority to mess around in your home. The release this week indicated there were many more. It does not include any repudiated for the first time by the Obama administration reflect a government shift on the underlying legal issues since Bush's departure. The defects in most of the early opinions were summarized in a document called Memorandum for the Files, signed by Stephen Bradbury, who was the acting head of the Office of Legal Counsel at the end of the Bush administration, trying to clean up the mess made by John Yoo and Jay Bybee. Bybee! Bradbury explained the defective legal opinions were issued in the wake of the atrocities of 9/11 when policymakers feared that additional catastrophic terrorist attacks were imminent and strived to employ all legal means to protect the nation, unquote. I.e., we were scared, so we did something wrong. He said the fact that legal flaws were noticed later, 4 years later, ladies and gentlemen, those pesky flaws they can hide, you see. They're like dirt that can hide in the floorboards, in the cracks. He said the fact legal flaws were noticed later was not meant to suggest that the authors did not satisfy professional standards. That might be relevant to the fact that the Office of Professional Responsibility in the Justice Department is still conducting an investigation to see whether, in fact, lawyers Yoo and Bybee did violate professional standards. Yoo's previously secret 37-page memo asserting the president could authorize a broad use of military force to combat terrorist activities inside the United States was completed 6 weeks after 9/11. In it, Yoo said any alleged terrorist in the United States could be treated like an invading army, justifying warrantless searches and the subordination of free speech and press rights if needed to, quote, wage war successfully. Nearly 7 years later, Bradbury declared that that memo contained several propositions that are either incorrect or highly questionable. You know, it takes a while. Who wrote these memos? You did. Who, you?
Just wrote and ran.
Who is you?
Torture memo man.
Who is you?
He went and banned the band.
Who is you?
Torture memo man. You got you some detainees. You don't know what to do. Their Miranda rights or cover them with poo? Are you doing something illegal or proper through and through? There's only one guy to call, the one to ask is you.
That is a bad mother.
Who is you?
He's in that secret clan.
Who is you?
Torture memo man.
say ooh. A little pain and torment might change their point of view. But before you waterboard them, you wonder, could they sue? One guy has got the answer, the one to ask is you.
Shut your mouth, I'm talking about God.
Who is you?
He just rose and ran.
Who is you?
Torture memo man. Went and banned the band.
Who is you?
Torture memo man. All these laws and treaties, you want something new. This war may last forever, you need to turn the screw. He's teaching law at Berkeley, he'll drop the other shoe. Bill of Rights expires, the one who knows is you.
Who is you?
Catch him if you can.
Who is you?
Torture memo man.
Who is you?
He just banned the band.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week. Won't you? Yeah, you will.
We're so sorry.
You already did. Deadline, Hanover, New Hampshire, Dartmouth students have apologized for writing a tongue-in-cheek news report full of racial slurs directed at the school's next president, the first Asian-American to lead an Ivy League school. The email was sent the day after the college announced that Dr. Jim Yong Kim would become its president. In July, it referred to Kim as a Chinaman and warned the campus to prepare for Asianification. Kim heads the Global Health and Social Medicine Department at Harvard Medical School, was born in South Korea and grew up in Iowa. The British Crown Prosecution Service has apologized to the family of a woman who was murdered by her abusive husband after his bail conditions were dropped despite his repeated threats to kill her. Malik Manan was jailed for a minimum of 17 years after fatally stabbing his wife, Sabina. Microsoft has apologized. No, not for that. Microsoft, huh? It's got to be easy to use. No, for the banning of an Xbox Live user who self-identified as a lesbian, even going so far as to call their policies inelegant. That was Microsoft calling them. The woman revealed her homosexuality in her Xbox Live profile. She was continuously harassed, and Microsoft banned her account, saying many gamers found, quote, her lesbianism offensive, unquote. Microsoft is looking into changing its policy. Currently, their Xbox Live policy bars the expression of relationship preferences in game tag profiles. Hong Kong, Dateline, Cathay Pacific Airlines has apologized for embarrassing a customer whose anguish after missing her flight was captured on video by an airline employee and posted on the internet. The airline said the worker who filmed the video had been disciplined, but that the person who posted the footage on YouTube was another person. Israeli military officials apologized. No, not for that. They say the country's Navy chief has apologized after he was sighted in a strip club. Admiral Eli Marom was spotted by a reporter in the Go-Go Girls Club in downtown Tel Aviv this week. Vanilla Ice has released a YouTube video apologizing to the public, stating, quote, I'm sorry. Even though Ice Ice Baby sold 40 million copies worldwide, I have no excuses. The hairdos, the baggy pants, the scandals, the lies, the gangs. And I'm sorry about the music. I was young. I was manipulated. I was a puppet. Unquote, Vanilla Ice. And Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Steele says he's reached out to Rush Limbaugh to tell him he meant no offense when he referred to the popular conservative radio host as an entertainer whose show can be incendiary. The latest in a line of Republicans apologizing to Rush. Rush Limbaugh, of course, has challenged President Obama to a debate on his radio show. I'm going to go on one better. I challenge the Pope to come on this show. Let's talk about abortion once and for all. The apology of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world to the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived, whenever you want it, at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available as a free download to members at www.audible.com/leshow, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com when it works. And it would be just like it working if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty. Thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist of music heard here on is available, usually. Along with so much other information, it's bursting. It's busting its buttons. I'm referring to the always evolving harryshearer.com. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. And thanks to Pam Halstead. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world. Oh, let's see. What's it really known for best? Is it really known for all the noise on the streets in the mornings? No. It's best known around the world as the home of the homeless.